Okay, maybe we should get started. Well, welcome to the LSE for this evening's event. My name is William Callahan, and I'm a professor here in the IR department at the LSE. And I'm really excited because one of my old friends and colleagues, Professor Frank Bieke from Leiden University in the Netherlands, is here to talk about his new book, Knowing China, on sale now. Is it a price? What is the price?
Off the top of my head, I wouldn't know, but it's around £14-15.
It's not expensive, so it's a bargain. High quality, low price. What more could you ask? Frank is the academic director of the Leiden Institute for Area Studies and the executive director of the Leiden Asia Center. And today, as I said, he's going to talk about his book, Knowing China, A 21st Century Guide. As we'll see, it's a really interesting book because it tries to use his specialist knowledge, because Frank is a specialist in China. He's been studying China and Chinese language and culture as an anthropologist for more years than he probably wants me to mention. And but he also wants to talk to a more general audience, whether it's a general intellectual audience or a policy audience. And he thinks that something's missing, that most of the think tank style books, am I saying everything you're going to say?
Yes, you are.
Most of the think tank style books are asking the wrong questions. So he's going to tell us not just what the wrong questions are, but what the right questions are. And joining us today to comment on this book are two of my other close colleagues, Professor Patricia Thornton from Oxford University, where she teaches Chinese politics, and Stefan Poitvang, the Emeritus Professor of Anthropology from here at the LSE. So what we'll do is a normal thing. Frank will come up here and speak for 10, 20 minutes. And then Patricia will give us about 10 minutes of her commentary, and then we'll go to Stefan. And then we'll open it up to the Q&A. So please put your mobile phones on silent. Our hashtag is hashtag LSE China, all one word, of course. And no further ado, I'd like to welcome Frank.
Clock here, yeah. All right, thank you very much. I'm extremely pleased that two of my very long-standing colleagues, Patricia Thornton and Stefan Feuchtling, have joined my old friend and colleague Bill Callan to talk about my latest book. It's very rare in academia that you are among friends in such a way. So I very much look forward also to what they have to say about my book, because actually people like Bill, Tia, and Stefan, I had in mind as an audience, as a readership, or one of the two readerships when I first embarked on this project. So one of the things I hope to be learning more about is whether I've been successful in what I hoped to accomplish. Now, what is that? As Bill already indicated, the book started fermenting in my head about 2-3 years ago, I'd say, out of a growing unease with the way that a lot of people in the social sciences, in humanities, but particularly and also in the media and in government, talk about China. It's not so much what they were saying and what kind of wisdom they divulged, but it was more the way that they approached China bothered me quite a bit. Very briefly, that approach is based on a very long-standing tradition in Western scholarship and Western thinking about China and other countries like that of opposition. There's the West on the one hand, and there is China, Japan, India, and so forth on the other. Now, that old Orientalist take, as it were, has gone through many, many different changes and evolutions, but it's still with us, also in the social sciences. And the problem is that it always looks at a country like China, and China is what we talked about, as in contrast to what we are. And what we particularly tend to do, and that bugs me the most perhaps, is that we look at what we think the realities, the ugly realities are in China, and then we compare that with the ideal, what we think we should be. And then, of course, China always comes out short. The conclusion is always that China is lacking, China is behind, China must be helped, must be remedied. And strangely enough, that type of discourse has come back in the last 10 years. It actually wasn't so pronounced in the 80s and even in the 90s, but as China becomes more powerful and more present in the world, this old perception of China again comes to the fore and is beginning to more and more determine the way that people, including policymakers, are looking at that very important country. And that rubs up against my conviction, and I'm sure that's also the conviction of my colleagues here, is that we have to look at China in its own right and from its own perspective, what I call in this book a China-centered perspective of China, which is not the same as a China-friendly perspective. You could, of course, say many nice things about China and then everybody, well, particularly the government, would really like you, but that's not the point. The point is that you want to look at how China looks like and how the world looks like from a Chinese perspective. Of course, there are many Chinese perspectives, government perspective, media perspective, and so on and so forth, and they are, tend to be very different, but methodologically, I think the good starting point nevertheless is to start saying what do developments in China mean for Chinese actors and Chinese organizations and Chinese institutions. And that is usually what is not happening in social science discussions, let alone in more popular discussions on China. Right? And this can still come up with some pretty strong criticisms of what happens in China, but it's not a criticism then from a perspective of comparing China with us and then saying they are not like us and therefore they are less good than we are, but rather trying to measure China up against its own standards, its own objectives, its own goals of what a good society ought to be, what a good government ought to be, what a good economy ought to be. So that was the general background. The other aspect that weighed in quite heavily is that we China specialists know an enormous amount about China. There's been a huge amount of scholarship, specialist scholarship on Chinese politics, the Chinese economy, Chinese society, culture, and so on and so forth. And you know, the four of us are a very small sample of that scholarship. There are literally thousands of people doing work on China, often at a very, very high level. But there are hardly any people who try to bring it together, to synthesize this, to say, okay, what is it all at the end of the day, does it stack up to? So people like myself have been beavering away on aspects of Chinese government and the Chinese Communist Party in particular, and on Chinese migration, and other Chinese specialists have been doing similar things about their own specialization. But nobody has taken, well, hardly anybody, I would say, has taken a step back and said, okay, what are the general, the larger patterns here? And what kind of society is China really? What kind of politics does China have? And so on and so forth. And one of the few advantages of getting older, and Stefan over there is even older than I, so I'm sure he agrees even more, is that you know a little bit better what is out there. Right? Just have read a little bit more, you have had a chance to read a little bit more laterally rather than simply in depth. So as you approach 60, then you can sort of think, okay, let's try to put it all together, because I've read quite a bit, and you know, why not give that a shot? So that was the background to this book. And then I started thinking, well, how can I do this? Of course, I can't pretend to be a specialist in Chinese economics, Chinese sociology, Chinese politics, Chinese international relations, and so on and so forth. That would be ridiculous. But what I can do is try to distill some questions, some misguided questions from the literature and from the debate, and then look at what the relevant specialist literature has to say about these questions. So, and that is what I've tried to do. One other background that I should mention, and that's actually what I start the book with, is that my own personal interest has always been in what you could call the really existing socialism in China. That is the reason that I started studying China. I didn't start working on China because I fell in love with the culture or with the people or the language. That came later. But what really started me on China was the fact that it was a socialist society, and I wanted to know what socialism actually meant as a lived-in reality rather than as an ideology or an ideal. And it, of course, could also have chosen Eastern Germany or the Soviet Union, but at that time, China was somehow felt a pure socialist society, less tainted by revisionism and all that.
You're dating yourself.
Am I, really? So that was why I became interested in China in the late 70s. Thank you very much, Bill. That in the late 80s, of course, an event happened in China, which we now know as the Tiananmen movement, that was suppressed. I was part of that. I participated in it. I was in Beijing for the whole duration, and that has permanently changed me, like many other people who were there at that time. And I was convinced after the suppression that the Chinese Communist Party as a ruling organization in China had no future whatsoever. This was the end game, or the beginning of the end game, or the middle of the end game, or the end of the end game. Anyway, time was up here. And I was singing along in a very large chorus of people who were basically saying the same thing. They were saying China cannot continue to be communist because communism is ultimately an evil system and an evil ideology, and Western political systems are inherently better. That's ultimately what we were saying. And of course, we all know that that was wrong, because China is still ruled by the Chinese Communist Party. The Chinese Communist Party has become stronger than it ever was before, and China as a country is more prosperous than it's ever been, and seems to be more stable as a society and a political system than it perhaps ever has been in its entire history. So the question really is, why was I so wrong? And not me, why was I so wrong, but why were most of the people that were looking at China at that time so wrong? So what is it that the Chinese Communist Party has done right to make us wrong? So that was the question that has driven me over the last 15, 20 years. And that points to one thing that we have to look at very carefully, and that is the Chinese Communist Party itself. Now, this is really strange when you say that, because that sounds obviously true. But when you look at the literature on China, the specialist literature, there are very few people who actually specialize in the Chinese Communist Party. Lots of people do things having to do with politics, international relations, and so on and so forth. But the number of people that specialize in the Communist Party as an organization, or as what an entity, because it isn't really an organization quite often, as an entity, there are very, very few. Perhaps there are 10, 15 people in the whole world who can self-confidently state that they are specialists who have something useful to say about the Communist Party as such, as a specialist on that. So this book tries to put the Communist Party right at the heart. And not its ideology, but its governing practice. What does it do in China that makes China work, and that makes it seem, at least, or perhaps it is also, ever more successful? Now, if you want to understand and explain that, then the first thing you have to do, and that's what I do in the book, is to step away from this Western idea that there is, or not even Western, this general idea that China is socialist in an ideological sense, and that socialism as an ideology is opposed to capitalism as an ideology, or liberalism as an ideology. In other words, you have to step away from a mid-20th century worldview in which the world is divided in opposite camps that are completely at loggerheads and like oil and water will never be able to mix. And the only thing that can come out of the interaction between these different ideologies and systems is the defeat of one by the other. You have to step away from that. Why? Because China shows that that is not the case. It's very, very simple. People looking at China still to this very day ask me the question, why, how long will it take before capitalism, the market economy, will finally erode away the fundamentals of power of the Communist Party? That discourse is still there. And my point is that that is still is a mid-20th century way of looking at the world in the 21st century. We are in the 21st century where ideologies are no longer what they seem, and political systems are no longer what they seem. All political systems, and especially, but not exclusively, the Chinese political system, are what I call recombinant configurations of different systems, different ideologies, different ideas that are being, have been patched together pragmatically. Right? So there is no such thing anymore as a socialist system. There is no such thing anymore as a capitalist system. Each system has elements of all kinds of other systems put together in a perhaps makeshift way, but they do work, and especially in China, it does work. And that is really the point that undergirds this whole book. So a recombinant way of looking at China, a recombinant sense that things not only are not only patched together, but then they start living a life of their own, they start evolving, right? And when you look at the way that the Chinese Communist Party has operated in the last 20 years, is what you see, rather than opposition of capitalism and socialism, you see that these two quote-unquote systems or non-systems have been repositories of ideas and practices and techniques that have been put together that have allowed the party system, political system, and the economy to reinforce each other, to strengthen each other, and also to condition each other. Now, obviously, and that point is made in the economics literature quite often, you need a state to set the parameters for a proper market economy to be regulated and to grow and prosper. But there is much more going on than just that. Because the market, the growth of the market economy in China provides the funds and provides also the impetus and the reason for the party to grow. So the party needs the market economy to get the funds to build up its own structures and its own systems and its own people even. And the party, moreover, thinks that it needs to grow bigger and stronger because of the things that the market economy does to Chinese society. So its own actions are not predicated on trying to retreat from society and let the market take over, but rather it finds that it needs more governance, not government, but more governance because of the growth of the government, and therefore it needs more party. So both at a practical level, financial level, and at a level of, let's say, political strategy or governmental strategy, the party grows because of the growth of the market economy, because of the growth of capitalism. Now this phenomenon I've called neo-socialism, but you can also put any other word on it. The word doesn't matter. The reality is what really matters here. And that is something that is, I think, in the literature and in public debate about China, insufficiently realized, that these things need each other and have brought forth a new system that is not capitalist, it's not socialist, it's something new, and it is a pragmatic, shifting and evolving system that is also open-ended in its consequence, because nobody can, in his right mind, can ever predict whether the Communist Party will fall or not, or what China will look like in 20 years, right? But you have to at least work on the assumption that the system as it is works and will continue to evolve, unless you see important evidence to the contrary. Okay? And this is a way of looking at China that, as I said, is China-centered, not China-friendly, China-centric, that does not try to measure China against these norms of behavior and political action that we have in the West, but rather looks at it how it actually works in China itself. Now, I've done that Now I'll stop there. I've done that by looking at some pretty, what I think are pretty common sense headings. One is the Communist Party itself and the political system, in which I try to explain how the Communist Party works as a political machine, as it were. Then how the economy has shifted and changed over the years and is becoming now a beast that is a genuine hybrid of a communist system and a market economy. I look at society and all the different developments that take place, which have generated for many people in China, not all, many people in China, very considerable freedoms to do what they want, live the life that they want. Within parameters, but within these parameters, people are very free, I would say just about as free as they are in the Western world. And moreover, China is becoming highly diverse in all the kinds of lifestyles that are now being lived by people and that are now being possible in China, including also religious freedoms. Then I turn to the issue of China's cultural and ethnic diversity and the old bugbears of Taiwan and Tibet, and I finally talk about China's international relations and its place in the world. So, as a conclusion, I'm not going to say that the Chinese Communist Party is going to fall or not going to fall. I'm also not going to say anything about whether Xi Jinping is indeed the new Mao Zedong, or whether we all go back to the future of the bad Maoist days. These are all misguided questions. What we have to look at is how Xi Jinping now is using the tools and resources at his disposal, political tools, cultural tools, to create a new form of governance for himself, for the people around him, and for the Communist Party as a whole. When you look at that, and suddenly Xi Jinping is no longer Mao Zedong. Now he's somebody who's picked and chosen certain things that he knows about Mao Zedong and other leaders, and has put these together to suit his own purposes and his own style of rule. So look again, don't look at China trying to measure it, but look at China as an evolving and pragmatic system. That's really the message of the book, and that only that will allow you, I think, to deal with China pragmatically. Quite often the question is, what should we do in terms of China's human rights abuses? Should we condemn it or not? Or should we condemn the way that China is operating in Xinjiang or Tibet? And these are wrong questions, because you have to ask yourself, what do we want from China? What do we think is important? And with whom in China could we work towards the things that we want to achieve within the parameters of normal ethical behavior? Right? So the question ought not to be to wag your finger and say China is a bad boy and gets a low mark on his human rights score. That is not really very productive, doesn't get you very far. You have to ask the question, what is it that we think is something, are people and organizations and institutions that we can work with to achieve things that they want and that also suit our own values? Okay, I'll leave it at that. I'm sure that Bill, Tia, and Stefan are not going to tear me to shreds, and I look forward to that very much. Thank you.
Do you want to stand up, or you can do it from the...
Up to you, what do you think?
Is this on? Yeah, maybe it's better, because there might have been some problems hearing from right there.
Better do it from right here. Okay. All right. I wanted to begin by, first of all, congratulating Frank on a terrific book. I really enjoyed reading it, and I'm really looking forward to discussing it. And I want to say, in all honesty, that Frank's work is one of the reasons why I'm here. Not here at the LSE, I mean here in New York. You can tell from my American accent that I was born and raised outside of New York City. And I did all of my academic training in the United States as a political scientist. But I found it incredibly constraining and frustrating, especially as it pertains to the study of China. Because the work that it was being produced in the 1980s and early 1990s in the United States was, I think, very U.S. focused, still driven by a rather Cold War agenda, works that were looking for China to democratize and then bringing, or collapse, or then collapse, in the case of Bruce Gilley, collapse, then democratize. And really, there was not a very broad range of understanding outside of those two poles, particularly after 1989. So I found that really, to be honest, very stultifying, because it seemed as though they were trying to fit Chinese politics into a prefabricated mold, and that mold was often defined by U.S. national interests. So as I began to read more widely and outside of the discipline of political science, I came across Chang's work, actually, as still as a graduate student, and I found it incredibly refreshing. And I was very much drawn to it because he seemed, in some ways, very non-ideological. But I'm going to come back to that in a minute, because that is where some of the problems or the issues that I have with the book that I want to discuss. But I did want to point out that one of the things that I do like about the book so much is it's called Knowing China. And he didn't mention why he chose that for the title. So I'm going to give it my own hermeneutic interpretation here, and then he can shoot that down later. But I understood the knowing part to be an attempt to get away from the teleological reading, which he says he's going to reject, not this question about what's going to happen to China, why is it not going to democratize, why are the Chinese not going to look like us. So he's dispensing with the telos, but he's instead engaging us in a rather different epistemological project, that is to say, what do we think we know about China, how can we know China better, what does it mean to know China? And I think he does an absolutely brilliant job of probing at that question, at dispensing with the telos, the idea of some sort of predetermined endpoint, and instead engaging us into thinking more and reflecting more on what it is we think that we know about China. And I like that very, very much about the book. Then the second thing I wanted to say that I really enjoyed about the book and about Frank's work more generally is that he enjoys grappling with the complex hybridity of the Chinese system. And you just heard him in this talk do that. I took a little bit of time today to go back over my old graduate student notes. And I found that if we go way, way back when I was a much, much younger woman, Frank was using terms like capital socialism, market socialism, and even I found a British inter-university, a BIC, China Center paper, in which Frank was pioneering the term market Leninism, briefly. So Frank has been actually, for many decades, I hope I don't insult you by saying decades, Frank, but we're all getting older, let's face it. He's been working with this sort of hybrid concept and trying to develop a new language, a new way to talk and think about the hybridity that China is that doesn't fit neatly into any of our preconceived categories. And when he talks about neo-socialism, I have here this quote he has on page 118. This is why the term neo-socialism might be a useful descriptive term that highlights both the recombinant nature of the political system and the party's adherence to its Leninist core. Under current conditions, nothing more should be read into neo-socialism. China's evolution is pragmatically determined and not prescribed by an ideology that serves as an anchor or a yardstick for policy making. Now, elsewhere in the volume, Frank talks about this magical core, or what is this again?
Sacred void.
This sacred void, yes, that exists within the party. Getting beyond, I mean, this question of the party's adherence to its own Leninism, or even a hybrid Marxist-Leninist Mao Zedong thought formulation, and let's not forget Jiang Zemin's important thought of the three represents, which we also have to throw in there. I wanted to hold Frank's feet to the fire just a little bit about his emphasis on the pragmatism aspect. Frank seems to be saying over and over again that the Chinese Communist Party has dispensed more or less with ideology. So I wanted to put a little pressure on Frank tonight to say a little bit more about that, because if we've read anything or learned anything or seen anything about China under Xi Jinping, we've seen in some ways a return to what might be considered more traditional democratic centralism and modes of control that are being imposed with an emphasis on the centralism. There's been a lot less pluralism, a lot less debate, or there's been a narrowing, I think, of the debate in the public sphere in China, and this is being policed, I think, quite sternly. by people under Xi Jinping, and there's been obviously also a lot of self-censorship. But at the same time, there are people and have been people writing and thinking and engaging in the Chinese public sphere, and there's a very rich ideological landscape that I think we can look at. And we talked before Xi Jinping came to power, there was a lot of discussion about the tensions between either the new leftists, represented by people like Bo Xilai, and then on the other side, the liberal pluralists, the liberal constitutionalists. These, some people would consider these the new rightists in the Chinese context. However, actually, the Mercator Institute is a think tank in Berlin, and they're putting together a really fantastic new workbook on mapping the ideological landscapes of contemporary China. And they've managed to come up with a lot more terms, and I agree with their designations. I mean, beyond the simple distinctions, if you will, between the new left and the new right, you have liberal humanists, you have old leftists, you have people who are interested in seeing China become more like a Scandinavian sort of Nordic, what would we say? Yeah, social democracy, but even perhaps thinking about pushing the Chinese system, I guess, in that direction, but less probably more consociational democracy, I think, if you could call it that. You also, however, have neo-nationalists and people who are very China-centric. And in the latest research that was done by Merrick's, and they polled a group of self-identified public intellectuals, two of them actually out and out identified themselves as fascists. Fa Qi Si, actually using the Chinese term for fascism, which I found really shocking because they were both Chinese Communist Party members. And apparently they forgot that communism was in many ways struggling with fascism, you know, in the earlier part of the 20th century. So there is this rich ideological landscape that's out there. We have Xi Jinping, who seems to be engaging with the party and the party's ideology now on a new level. They're encouraging people at the grassroots to do the same. You have this new grassroots campaign to be copying out the Chinese Communist Party's constitution by memory on your honeymoon. I don't know if any of you have seen this, but apparently this is the new thing to do when you get married in China.
What else is there?
So one child, the one child policy. Anyway, but I wanted to press Frank a little bit. I think we'll go to Stefan next, but I hope that I could ask Frank to say a little bit more about why it is that he thinks that ideology is not where the Chinese Communist Party is headed, or it's not as important as it has been in the past. I mean, I have a lot. There are a lot of other issues that I have with the book, including his characterization of the Communist Party under Mao as basically a personalized dictatorship. But we can leave those, I think, for the question and answer session. Right now, what I want to hear from Frank most is about why it is that he really seems to think that ideology has become less important. I would suggest that actually ideology may be becoming more important.
Okay, thank you, Stefan.
Right. I also want to, rather embarrassingly, praise Frank. it is a really good book, and I think he's done marvelously to draw things together, to synthesize not just the anthropological level of his own ethnography and his probably the only ethnographer of the party, and the party's called in you now. But also in the economics, the international relations, and all those things, and puts it all together in a really useful way, and asks really sensible questions. And in each chapter, there are serious questions that almost amount to saying that which manages China, the party, has to deal with a certain number of things which could almost be said to be critical in crisis. Mm-hmm. And I'll mention those in a minute when I've got my notes. The want to mention that, then I'm also going to, just like you, going to end up with a question I want to put to Frank and to see if it would be possible in the organisation of this thing to answer. Various words that Frank has used to describe, like recombinatory or neo-socialist, are sort of hybridities in which he uses the older terms used in 20th century political science of China, but puts them together. I'm not sure that's enough. One really needs to be thinking of new concepts generated from within or without China. One of the things that you say is another one that you use is the notion of consultative democracy. Mm-hmm. I can understand what that refers to. It refers to petitions, which the whole petition system, which only works if you make trouble, as Anders have already said. But there is also the so-called representative communities of neighbourhood and urban neighbourhood and village, which are not called the same thing. Communities should choose. And they have feedback. They're supposed to provide feedback. So that I'm not quite sure whether that's consultative, but there is some kind of feedback system which is at work. And one of the things that Frank does very nicely is show how he never uses the word legitimacy, but I'm going to use it now. The rule is legitimated or justified in a set of terms that has deeply changed from communism to socialism to being well off, to, in other words, to develop people's livelihood, to advance people's livelihood, and now to heritage, culture. And I completely endorse that, having just come back from China, that there is a really strong emphasis on culture, and it's part of the the one belt one route. Chinese understand that, and in English it's completely incomprehensible. It means moving through Central Asia towards Europe, moving around the coasts of the sea in the maritime silk route.
The maritime road.
Yeah, the maritime road, which is a silk road. Now that's got a lot of money behind it, and it can and once there is a lot of money behind a general policy, lots of people make different interpretations of it and try to get the money that's available in order to put on these projects, and they're largely cultural projects. Well, they're not only cultural projects, but culture is a big part of it. I'm afraid I've just come back from Tranjo, which is the maritime silk route's claim to be the centre of it, or the opening of it. And there it's a great deal of it is cultural, as well as religious. But a number of things I wanted to emphasize a bit more than perhaps Frank does is, or to try to think differently about, is the way that since the reforms and increasingly right up to now, what he calls society, using that old term, political science, state and society, which I don't like much, has been liberated. That's your term. Increasingly, under the tutelage of the CCP, that's also your term, and amongst that liberation, you include lobbies. And by the way, I think it's not just ex-ministries. I can think of many other lobbies that are not ex-ministries. Mm-hmm. For instance, property development companies and management companies have their own lobbies. So do house owners' associations have their own lobbies. That just comes out of my own research, and there are many others. So that's a liberation, that's something. In each case, yeah, banks have lobbies. I'm just trying to hedge before I come to my big question. But I wanted to give one further exposition of Frank's book. There are several points that he asks in each chapter, which are coming to a critical point now. So bank reform is some kind of financial reform is obviously going to be necessary because there's so many bad debts, especially at local government level, and I completely conform with that. There's an ecological crisis, which is being dealt with. There's an aging population crisis of care, and there are military confrontations in the South Seas. And all of these could lead to less manageable situations than the general picture of the book gives. I wanted to, than the party has managed so far. So I guess a question might be arising from the book, but this is not my big question, is what, whether Frank's solution to the management crisis of these, or the management of these crises, is really the only one. The solution Frank offers is that the party needs to become transparent. Mm-hmm. It needs to open up its sacred void, mm-hmm. and open itself up to the existence of factions within it. Mm-hmm. I've read from the party school, party university, an article by a party member saying that's what it should do. So I'm not saying there aren't people in China that are saying this too, but I wonder whether in fact it's necessary. Why can't the party go on as it is and still manage these crises? But now the big one. Why do you continue to use the word totalitarian? You didn't mention that, but it's right at the beginning of the book. It goes along with your description of it as Leninist. And you do quote Hannah Arendt on totalitarianism. But for Hannah Arendt, totalitarianism meant ruling for the sake of realizing an ideology. Or atomization. Now, neither of those things are occurring in China half as badly as they are here. So I'm just not sure why it is that you still stuck with that word. So that's my big question about the book, which otherwise I sit here, I stand here, and praise.
Okay. Since we are actually ahead of schedule, I'm going to add some comments because I think you wanted me to join the roast. I will unapologetically join people to join my colleagues in praising the book. It's an excellent book. It's very well written. It's very clear. I think what you do is you take the strategy that I've tried to take, but you do it better. I call it the Huntington strategy. The Samuel Huntington Clash of Civilizations. Not in terms of content, but it's like Frank is going to piss off so many people with this book that people are going to say, Frank, you're wrong. Whether you're coming out from a left or a right or a centrist position, and I think that is great. You will get a lot of citations. But I also thought, wow, this is what you can do when you leave British system of the research excellence framework, because Frank used to work with us at Oxford, that's how I know him, and you left in 2010, back to your native Holland. And so I don't think this would count for the RAF, unfortunately for us, fortunately for you, because it's a think piece. It's really engaging, but it's not the sort of standard monograph where he's giving lots of Chinese language sources to back himself up. We trust that you know all these things already from your experience and your other writings. My question for you, I guess I'm going to pile on from what Tia started talking about and talk about ideology, but in a slightly different way. You say that China's not, or the Communist Party is not ideological, or we should not think of it in ideological terms because it's pragmatic, and it, as you and other people have said, it combines things in a sort of a dynamic hybridity. But as I guess one of my colleagues once said, he's sitting right over there, Chris Hughes, he said, pragmatic? Pragmatic for what? What is the goal of pragmatism? Pragmatism is not a goal. It's a means to an end. What is the end? Is it just the survival of the CCP, or is it something else? It doesn't have to be an ideological goal. And secondly, and I guess the last question that I'll ask, is you say that the problem with a lot of social science analysis is that it's ideologically driven. And I can agree with you that a lot of the questions, the way you pose a question produces a certain range of answers, and we should be critical of that. But I don't think that we can ever be without our own ideology. So what is your ideology? It's better to just admit it, that you're a social democrat, you're a liberal, you're a Sinophile, I don't know, or maybe you're a dog lover. So that's it. Ideology, pragmatism, ideology, and what is your ideology? So we'll let Frank answer our three questions, and then we'll open it up to the Q&A.
All right. Well, what I feared might happen has actually happened, and that is that these three incredibly intelligent and well-informed people ask many more questions than I can possibly ever answer. In fact, there are several questions that I asked myself and tried to dodge in the book, and now I have to admit that I've obviously been unsuccessful in doing so. Ideology, yeah. The party has not dispensed with ideology in the sense that it doesn't produce any ideology. In fact, it produces great quantities of ideology. We still are having a Chinese dream. We still have core socialist values. Another one that a few years ago came along was the five dimensions. All of that doesn't matter what it means. The Chinese Communist Party constantly produces ideology, and in fact is producing much more of it now than, say, 10 years ago. That is, as I call it, pragmatic ideology. To me, that is the, I think, the mistake that we almost unwittingly make is that we think that this is ideology with a capital letter I. But it's not an ideology that actually wants to say how the world really is and how it ought to be and how we should work towards getting there. But it served, its object is also not the common people in China. Its main object and the main users of it are Chinese Communist Party members themselves, and particularly cadres. They are the prime target of the ideology, and they're the ones who are supposed to use it. And when you look at how ideology is being used within the party, and I was sort of witness to that in during my research in party schools a bit earlier, 10 years ago or so, then it is very clearly a language to talk about political action. And of course, language that also defines what the limits are within which legitimate political action can take place, and what the legitimate objects are of that political action. But it's all, at the end of the day, a guide and a tool for political action within the Communist Party. That is what it does. And as such, it is surprisingly unimportant. I'm not saying it's completely unimportant, but it's surprisingly unimportant exactly what it is that that ideology says. You can talk about politics using any kind of ideological language that the Communist Party produces. The only thing that is really important is that you use the right language at the right time. You shouldn't use the wrong language. But it doesn't matter what that language is. The language itself is, I'm quite often tempted to use it, call it an empty signifier. Now this is overstating the point, but it's getting pretty close to it. So it is pragmatic ideology that is used within the context of the Communist Party by Communist Party members. Gone are the days, the Maoist days, in which ideology was something that was supposed to be propagandized across the population and genuinely change people's thinking and behavior and goals in life. That's no longer the case at all. Now, and that also then starts addressing questions asked particularly by Stefan. What has taken its place? And since I wrote this book, I started writing another paper. That's all that happened. You know, the paper that you're writing now is much more interesting than the paper that you've written 2 years ago, in which I tried to look at the issue that you raised of the increasing role of culture, heritage, and also religion in Chinese politics and Chinese society. And I've looked at something extremely tedious, namely the so-called red tourism. Now, red tourism is tourism to sites designated and created, built, beautified by local governments or sometimes central government for the use of tourists across China to go there and to partake in the wonders of the Chinese Revolution. So these are sites where important revolutionary deeds or events happened, and as such these sites are still suffused with something. Something that's meaningful, something that's important. And what you see is that, and this is really surprising, that came out of recent research that I've done, is that this strategy of red tourism, well, first of all, it builds on a long-standing tradition of using such sites also before, about 10 years ago, but in 2004 it became a national policy in which a lot of money was invested. So they raised the bar, as it were. But what you see in red tourism is that it's now also being used not just for the common people, but also for Chinese communist carters themselves. They become the object of such red tourism propaganda indoctrination work. They create special sites, or they create special wings of sites or special museums at a particular site, specifically targeting carters who have to go there as part of a carter training program in order to learn about and to be suffused by, and this is a term that is quite interesting, what I could call party spirit. So the changes that are taking place in the Communist Party are no longer a matter of simply party discipline. That, of course, we know all about from Xi Jinping's campaigns, but there's also a broader campaign taking place about party spirit that is supposed to transform people and turn people from ordinary friends, lackeys, subordinates into comrades. And this is a very old-fashioned Leninist term, but it's been resuscitated, it's been reused and been put in a completely new footing. Now, I will not go into the details of the paper. I hope it will be published somewhere, somehow, if I find some friendly reviewers. But the point here is that culture and revolutionary heritage are beginning to play an incredibly important role in the way that the Communist Party is restyling itself as a governing institution that is no longer simply a governing institution, but also a religious institution. Not in the sense that it has a religious ideology or a dogma. It is not in that sense religious, but it's religious in a Durkheimian sense, that it is sacred. So the point is increasingly that you believe in the party, not because you believe in what it says, but simply because you believe in it. Full stop. You don't believe in anything, you just believe that the party is sacred and has a sacred right to rule. Perhaps I'm overstretching the point here a little bit, but I don't think I am. Let me see. Now then, T.S. points about other types of ideologies in the Mercator study, which I haven't read yet, but I can sort of picture what it will look like. It's a very fine institution, Mercator Institute, and do very, very good work. So I'm very much looking forward to it. But these people that they seem to be talking about are mainly the sort of public intellectuals, and not the party itself. So for public intellectuals, yes, intellectuals always talk about ideology and all that. That's what we do, right? And China is no exception. It has says much less about discussions and debates that are taking place in the Communist Party. And the debates and discussion in the Communist Party are, to a very large extent, not ideological, in the sense of ideology as defining great objectives, fundamental orientations, all that. Right. That is not the discussion you don't see. But then going to both Stefan's point and I think also Bill's point, what I do see currently with Xi Jinping and the way he has evolved, and I've said this at a conference a few years ago as well, is that the Communist Party and its rule are no longer simply neo-socialist, i.e. both capitalist and Leninist or communist, but indeed they also are acquiring aspects of fascism. So these people that you mentioned that call themselves, self-consciously call themselves fascists, and they are Communist Party members, that's no coincidence. And in fact, I gave an interview, I gave a talk at the Dutch Ministry of Foreign Affairs and an interview to a national newspaper in Holland, in which I made this point as well. I used the word fascist and I was advised by somebody who was in this room that perhaps using fascists or fascism is not the greatest term. In China it doesn't translate so well, but now I'm convinced that it actually may be a good term to use. And instead I use the word national socialism, which translates really well in Chinese. It means 无社会主义. Sounds really good. So the point is that the party goes on, right? It keeps on evolving, it keeps on changing, keeps on drawing on new practices, new ideas, new ways of survival. And the regime of Xi Jinping, yes, is different from Hu Jintao, but only in the sense that it is evolving. It's not something fundamentally different. One thing that I would want to emphasize, that we, for as long as I've looked at China, there's always been this alarmist tendency of saying, oh my God, in China things are really going out of control, it's going pear-shaped, this is the end. Forgetting that this is a matter of policy cycles and this is a matter of change and evolution, and that after the current phase of retraction, of anti-corruption, of increasing discipline, let's put it this way, eventually another phase will follow. This is just an ongoing circus, right? And moreover, the things that Xi Jinping does are indeed different, but they're not different in kind. It's a part of a process of constant accretion of new elements in order to make sense of and deal with the realities of today, right? So the system itself hasn't fundamentally changed. The society hasn't fundamentally changed. It keeps on going, keeps on developing and evolving. Yeah. Point about society, I don't think I said in the book, but maybe I did, if I said I'm wrong, that society has been liberated by the party, but society has been created by the party. When you look at the bad old days of state socialism, then you essentially didn't have society as a separate unit. Society and state and party were interwoven, were part of the same thing. And the thing about reform has been that society has been pulled out, has been allowed to become autonomous and become a sphere of action, of operation in its own right, separate from the state and the party. So that the separation of the state and the party on the one hand and society on the other hand, that is a product of reforms, that's a given, that's a gift of the party itself.
Right? You do say that too, but you do say it.
Okay, well, then I'll cross that out in the second edition. Then very briefly, Bill's point, Huntington's strategy, it's not so much a strategy, it's my psychology. I always like to piss people off, and not only in this book, but in general, I always do that, right? And as an administrator now, which I am, I'm only an administrator, I don't do any original work anymore, I use the same strategy, and I can tell you it really works. I already have a very large number of people who really hate my guts in my department. Let me see. I think I'll leave it at that.
Totalitarian.
Yeah. I wouldn't get hung up too much about the word, quite honestly. I've used it simply as a descriptor of a system that came before, of which certain essential elements are still in place. But I don't want to get hung up about all the details of full-blown totalitarianism as described, for instance, by Hannah Arendt. But I do not want to then do the cowardly thing and not use it and find another less controversial word instead. Because I do want to show, and that is probably why I use it actually, that there is still a very important direct connection between the Communist Party as it is now, how it looks at itself, what it wants to do, and the party from before 1978. Yeah.
Okay, so let's open it up to Q&A. We'll gather like three questions first. Please identify yourself.
Hi, my name is Bernard. I'm sitting with PhD in Jenny from Florida State. I take a year off to study politics at LSE. And I have a couple of questions. It's about the international relation and economic growth dimension. First question, do you think, is there any potential war between Vietnam and China over the South China Sea conflict in the future? And if there is a war, how big it is? And
who will win?
And I'm actually originally from Cambodia, and so my question is, you know, what should a small country like Cambodia do in terms of foreign policy, the balance between China and the US? And in terms of economic growth, like, you know, China has resources, land, labor, capital, and entrepreneurship, and advanced technology, and, you know, have a like free market economy to support all this. Like, what's going on? How come China have all that? Like, let's say from 1980. And,
okay, I think that's enough. one question, please. I think you're next.
Right. Hello, I'm Jos. I'm a student with Stefan at the LC. Thank you very much for the presentation. It was very delightful. You mentioned something about the growth of the market economy provides the impetus for the CCP to grow. Does that then mean that the legitimacy of the CCP is linked to the economic success of China? And by extent, speculatively, in case the economic success is not there anymore, how will it then change to legitimize itself? Mm-hmm.
Another question out there?
Okay, I just have a clarification. You mentioned that distinct ideology is more targeted at the CCP campus and not at the larger population.
Mm-hmm.
But you also mentioned about this red tourism.
Yeah, red tourism.
Yeah. But if you look at from the Chinese perspective, from the Cultural Revolution to the People's War, the impact of the mass People's War, the ideology of that, and the people fighting for the CCP itself, has been some sort of gathering force for them. So if we look at that from the red tourism perspective, if we are not targeting ideology as something to hold the people together, then what is the purpose of the red tourism?
Okay, right.
Okay, I'll start with the last one because I still remember it. The whole point about red tourism is to do exactly what I tried to explain, which you could, for lack of a better word, perhaps call pre-ideological. So it creates a sense of attachment, belonging to an habitual sense of being part of a society of which the Communist Party is obviously the most important center and sacred component, that has nothing to do with specific and explicit ideological ideas. It's simply there, and it simply is therefore believed in. It's not believed anymore. Right? So you don't have to explain anymore. The Communist Party does this because it wants to achieve that, and therefore you have to believe in what it does. Yeah. Or you have to believe, yeah? It simply says, Communist Party is there, it exists, it's sacred because of its revolutionary history and what it has done for China and how it helped save China. The sacred deeds of its leaders, these are so superior, have so much efficacy, because that's the word, yeah? In the Chinese, you would call that jinshen. Yeah, of course, it's a religious term, but I'm using it very advisedly. So the party has efficacy, has strength, has power, simply because of its sacred status. Yeah? So it's pre-ideological. Ideology doesn't come in. That's the whole point about red tourism. But the scary thing is that they're also using that now to target cadres. Okay? So even cadres are now treated not as believers anymore, but simply as members of the general populace that ought to be imbibed with this jingchen, this efficacy, and therefore remain loyal to the party. There were a couple of questions about, well, first of all, Joost's question about the legitimacy of the CCP linked to economic growth. That's a standard question that everybody asks. And they ask it themselves as well. When you talk to, when you are spoken to by very high central leaders, then they come up with a list of things that they have to deliver. These are very concrete, and they were mentioned by Stefan or somebody else. We have to solve inequality, we have to solve environmental pollution, we have to solve the aging problem, and so on and so forth. There's a whole list. I think there are about 9 points or so. And these are all problems that we have to solve. And they say, well, for all these problems, we have these and these measures, and we have this and this time frame, as if they're simply managing an enterprise. That's how they look at it. So they're very confident that they will deal with this, right? At least in explicit discussions. But when you look at what they do, this whole development of increasingly rooting the CCP's rule in culture and in history, that in itself is sort of a hedging their bets, isn't it? Right? It's a way of saying to themselves, well, in the long term, of course, economic growth won't be so spectacular. There may be problems that we can't quite solve. So we need something for the future, for the long haul. And this is it, I think. Yep. The war between China and Vietnam and the South China Sea. I get so tired of the South China Sea, and yet it is so important. It is obviously the first real theater of China as a newfangled superpower that tries to compete with the US, but every time it does so, it sort of stops just short of actually fully engaging. It's only that every time the conflict emerges, it takes one step further than it did previously. But it's never, I mean, the international relations specialists here know much more about this than I do, but it seems that they use this as a testing ground of how far they can go. Rather than really thinking of this as a conflict that they want to win right now. But it's a testing ground because it's close to home, it's where they feel quite secure still. They feel that it's also a trigger point for the United States. So in that sense, for them, it doesn't matter so much that there is a conflict that they need to win, but it's a way of seeing how far they can stretch their prominence in the world at the moment. But anyway, that's just my take. Maybe I'm completely wrong, and as I said, there's Chris Hughes there, probably going to say things that are entirely different and much more correct.
Okay, more questions? Ben, way in the back.
Yep.
Yes, shout.
Hi, Benjamin, student of field, doing my PhD at LSE. I'd like to thank you for to ask you the question on the idea of the sacred, because one of my chapters basically also talks about idea of the sacred and how how the sacred is linked to violence, and the idea of the scapegoating mechanism. These ideas were used by the French sociologist René Girard. So if that's the case, if the Communist Party sees itself, perceives itself as sacred, as in an in and but basically no other reference to any higher telos but just the CCP by itself, then how do you think, and the fact that in order for this sacredness to be preserved, how then do you see the scapegoating mechanism? Would you say the West therefore becomes a convenient scapegoat whereby the problems within China are therefore conveniently transferred out of China? Would that be a line of argument that we could make with reference to the idea of the sacred?
And behind you?
Hi, my name is Manoj, and I'm from Nepal, and I'm doing MSc Local Economic Development here. So my question is, if you look at the 2011 GDP per capita, China was $5,500, but there were at least 17 regions in China that was more than double of that. So can you really paint one China story, or are there different countries within China?
We have a third question. Yes?
Should I do this?
Yes, please.
Okay. Let me see. There is a question by Ben about scapegoating in the West, right?
Okay.
I didn't quite understand how you connected that up with the sacred void, quite honestly.
Okay. Maybe to clarify. So basically, in order to preserve culture, or at least this was the argument made by this French sociologist, he argues that in order to preserve social order, and because of the fact that the Communist Party is seen as sacred, there's this idea of mimetic desire where each person tries to imitate others, and therefore this mimetic desire often leads to rivalry and conflict within the in-group. So in order for that conflict to be avoided, therefore there is need to scapegoat an out-group, an outsider group.
So I think that's somewhat similar to another question. I forget which one it was. My former PhD student, Xiang Biao, called this the Pacific Paradox. And there's other words that you can also find for that. You can call China a pest optimist nation, to just use a word coined by my neighbor here. China is a society like other societies with a profound internal cultural debate going on. These are anthropological terms that I think are very useful, just like the sacred void is also a term coined by anthropologists, in fact by the same anthropologists. So the relationship between China and the West has always been, on the one hand, one of desire. This is what we want to be, this is where we want to go, this is where we also want to belong, really. We want to be taken seriously. We want to be one of the big boys on the block. But on the other hand, a hatred. So they want to copy and they want to belong, but they also want to compete and they want to ultimately beat the bully. And China constantly goes back and forth between these two extremes. Quite sometimes even both things happen at the same time. You could say that that is currently what is happening. So it's not simply that the West is scapegoated, because it's all scapegoated, but it's also presented as really, that is where we want to go, that's what we want to be. But we also want to be ourselves. We want to be Chinese and we want to retain our own identity. In fact, that's why we want to be more like the West. We want to be like the West so that we can become more Chinese. And then that is the contradiction. We want a better, stronger Chinese by copying and becoming more like the West. And this is something that is not unique to the Communist Party. This goes back to the 19th century, right, since the open war in China. Then the issue of one China. I can talk about one China. No, of course you can't. But I'm not talking about China. I'm talking about China, but I'm talking about China through the lens of the CCP. And as such, you can actually generalize, because it's one organization or quasi-organization that you find throughout China doing similar things, not the same, but similar things in China. And as such, I think you can talk about China as a whole. Of course, you have to take into account the fact that there are huge differences in China. That is an obvious fact. But it doesn't, because China is a political unit and is tight and is strung together by this organization, you can say things generally about China. Now, what is the biggest threat to the CCP? That's very simple, it's the CCP. No totalitarian regime ever falls because of outside pressure. It falls because of inside fragmentation, factional struggle, infighting, divisions. China, of course, had that during the Cultural Revolution, as we know. And that is also the greatest threat. That's also why the Bo Xilai affair was such a big deal, because it brought back right squarely on the political agenda factional divisions that cut right through the whole party and spilled over into society in a way that hadn't happened since 1989. And that's why it was such a big deal. And they rightly, in my view, perceived that as the most important threat to the survival of the CCP. They, of course, also react allergically to activists, dissidents, and people that protest. But in a sense, that is not a threat, and they know it, to the survival of the CCP. Nothing can happen in society that will topple the CCP. The only thing that can topple the CCP is the CCP itself. And that not only holds for China, but also for North Korea, for instance. North Korea will never fall because of some uprising. Or because the economy becomes so bad that everybody dies, everybody will then simply die, like if you're integrating forward in China.
Yikes.
Yikes indeed, yeah, that's horrible.
Can I just mention something?
No, it's about totalitarianism.
No, it's something that I think the one China thing is that actually the chapter on effectively on the nation is extremely important. The point that Frank makes out is that actually there's been so much population movement, there are so many internal diasporas, that there is more sense to talking about China as a single nation than there was before.
I should also mention that when you're talking about red tourism, it made me think of when I went to Shanghai last year, when the red tourism cited Sun Tianbi about the founding of the Communist Party. So you can buy, of course, tourist sort of paraphernalia.
Mm-hmm.
And so I bought a passport, a Communist Party passport, where you can go and get a stamp from every red tourist site, like you are to kind of recognize that you've been there. So it's a very weird, interesting. And what was even funnier.
It's not weird, it's pilgrimage.
What was even funnier?
It's an alternative of the party about itself.
Yeah.
About its birth, its growth, its maturation.
Right. But what was funny is that the old cadre who sold me the passport was like, why are you buying this? You know, you're not Chinese and you're not a communist. Why are you buying this? But then she smiled and sold it to me and stamped it.
It was not expensive, I would say.
No, it was. Well. Okay, Chris, please. Chris Hughes.
Is there any students?
Is there anybody in the back?
What?
Okay, you there, yes.
I'm Eva from the International Relations Department. My question is a bit more abstract, and I'll try to put it a bit in context. So, today, probably the most mentioned word was ideology. A couple of weeks ago, there was a talk on China. So people focus on these concepts such as ideology, economic growth, and other concepts which I
question. That's a great question. Is there another question in the back? On the left, yeah, but.
Will Duffield, political theory, MSc, what do you see as the most likely causes or flashpoints that would lead to a physical conflict between the United States and China?
And there's another person back there. Yes.
Hello, I'm a student in our department. My question is that, yeah, Professor Stephen, the question asked by him is that about the term totalitarianism. So I'm thinking about what it really means to adopt a China-centric perspective, because it's very common that when we try to describe a phenomenon that is strange and different to us, we try to look for the terms and concepts that are very well known to us. But the problem is that how to really adopt a China-centric perspective.
Okay. I want to start with the last one. That's a very good point. How can you use terms that are alien to Chinese experience when you say that is China-centric? My point is not that I want to present an Yiwei perspective on China. I don't want to explain China in the terms of its own culture, but I want to look at the world and at China from the perspective of China. And you can use alien worlds for that. So it's not this is how Chinese think that the world is, but rather how does the world look like if you put yourself in China. That's really what I want to say. There's a subtle difference there, but the point is it's very well taken. The conflict flashpoint with the US, I don't think there will be a conflict with the US, quite honestly. I don't think that nobody wants that. I don't think neither of the two can afford it. And I don't see any fundamental contradictions between their interests, global interests, that would allow or would make it necessary for either of the two to go to the brink, quite honestly. There will be lots of little conflicts and little issues, but they will come and they will go, but they will never really take them to their final conclusion of having an actual full-fledged war. I don't think that will happen. And then your point, using these terms, ideology and economic growth, is also useful. It's useful for us because it allows us to make sense of what happens in China in terms that we can understand. But also these terms are used in China. So economic growth is a big deal in China. And increasingly they talk about what really matters to them, stability. Yeah? They talk about that in terms of economic growth. So to them, things like economic growth become then also an index of their success at delivering what they want most, stability and harmony. So I don't think there is a contradiction there. But you are right, we have a tendency to impose these things on China, and I think think that we understand it, whereas we actually don't. I agree with that.
Okay, we have 5 minutes left, so these have to be, this is like the speed question round. anyone? Yeah. Oh, you want to follow up on
that? Can I just follow up a quick question for Professor Patricia? You mentioned that we need to develop new language to describe China that does not obviously fit into the existing categories. And from your own experience in as a researcher in Chinese politics, what do you think is the solution and how Chinese and Western scholars can collaborate in creating that kind of new language to describe China?
That's a tough one. I think that language is already has already emerged because Chinese scholars, I'm not talking about policymakers, but scholars increasingly talk about the issues that they're researching in terms of our world from Western social science. So in that sense, we have a common language, and the translation has happened. Of course, the question is that, and the point is really, are we asking the same questions? And then quite often the answer is no. Having said that, of course, and that's something that, again, I got out of my party school research, is that underneath this layer of immediately recognizable scholarly research in China, at the main research university, there's a huge world of Chinese research in all kinds of institutions and schools that we know very little about, schools of public administration, party schools indeed, all kinds of training institutes, vocational institutions. And when you read what they write, and sometimes I have to do that, I was just flabbergasted at how different the discourse is structured in these publications. And also the utter lack of connect with anything that goes on outside of China. So yes, there is quite a bit of work to do there. Although, would people really want that? Quite honestly, I'm not even sure.
Okay, yeah, I wanted to say that I also got sucked into the whole parallel academic universe of party school publications because you can get them all online now, and it's just amazing. That's where the idea of Harmony came from in between 1999 and 2000. It didn't come from the philosophers. It came from these party school people who were arguing back and forth whether it was Marxist, whether it made sense, is it good for China or not. And then it became Hu Jintao's kind of main slogan. We have 2 minutes left, so I think what I'll do is just thank everybody on the panel. Patricia Thornton from Oxford, Seven Voigtwing from here at the LSE, and my old friend Frank Pica, now from Leiden. So join me in thanking.